So that is the injunction that Scott Kennedy, Cynthia Matthews, and Mike Rotkin got to drive away the protesters from City Hall, which of course has not succeeded in doing so, but at least four of them are facing misdemeanor charges of up to 6 months in jail. Actually, much more serious time than I was facing. I was facing 5 days in jail in front of Heather Morse. But nonetheless, the case is interesting because it shows you both how outrageous a judge can be, and also it gives you some indication of how the procedures operate in a contempt of court case. So, here you are. Morse versus Norse. Contempt of court, 1992. The casus belli, the reason for the contempt of court, a button that said, fuck judges without justice.
Issue in regard to Mr. Norse, and I am going to assign it a civil case number so that we might have a case number to refer to distinguish the matter as well as for any potential future hearings. 60-92-0228, case number hereafter assigned, available to both Ms. Wells and Mr. Norse. Present for the record, Ms. Wells appearing as counsel of record, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Morris is also present. I have read and considered the points and authorities in support of the recusal demand as well as the demand for recusal of myself. And at this time, is there anything that you wish to add in regard to these motions?
Being considered is a motion by Attorney Kate Wells that Judge Morse recuse herself or withdraw from the case because the actual contempt, so-called, was committed before her, and so she would not be an objective judge of the case.
Yes, I think so. The issue of the definition of immediate view and presence of the court, I can't find any case authority to define. And absent any case authority, I would think that the plain meaning of the words would control. And immediate view and presence would infer that there would that you would have your human view. You personally would be viewing the contempt. That is an issue of disputed fact in this situation. And under 170, if you have personal knowledge of an issue of disputed fact, and in fact it's even stronger in this case because you're the only one who can in fact testify as to whether or not it was in your immediate view and presence. And the issue is important, is material, because of the fact of the different procedures that are that direct versus indirect contempt are handled, the different prescribed processes. He would be entitled to affidavits and statements. And so that's basically all I have to say. Okay. I have read and considered, as I indicated, the motions which I just received this afternoon upon coming. Actually, I was on the bench when you arrived, and which were presented at the time that you came in. And this is, in fact, a proceeding pursuant to 1209 subsection A, 1 and 2, which are direct contempt. I believe that in that circumstance, the law dictates that the judge viewing the direct contempt should be the one holding the hearing and adjudicating the matter. Based on that, I will deny your motion for recusal or disqualification pursuant to 170.1 of the Code of Civil Procedure at this time. And I will ask that both of these items be filed and included into the court record at this time. The contempt, I think, is viewed perhaps as a bit too narrowly, I think, by Mr. Norse, in that can I clarify one thing before you go any further? Because I had written down at the last hearing that he was being charged with a violation of 1209A1 and 5.
I believe that since
you just said 1 and 2, I just wanted to.
I believe that it is. Let me have to check to make sure.
Thank you. too. The lawful order that I had considered in the indicating of the file is when I asked him to leave the courtroom. And he was thereafter escorted by the deputies out and told not to return to the courtroom, displaying the button, which he would remove it or stay out of the courtroom, basically. And he returned to the courtroom after I had him escorted from the courtroom, displaying the button, and once again refusing to remove the button or leave the courtroom there for causing further disturbance and interruption of the proceedings. Okay, so I'm thoroughly confused at this point. It is 1 and 5 or 1 and 2?
1 and 2.
The order of the court was to leave the courtroom or remove the button. However, it was not a judgment or order in regard to an official court order such as a sentencing. So it is actually 1 and 2. It's interruption of court proceedings. So a breach of the peace and boisterous conduct. Okay, well, I had prepared my defense. Of course, I'm 1 and 5, but I'm sure I can take care of it. Let me at this time indicate that I would like to make a complete record in support of this matter. And so in order to do so, I would at this time indicate that on March 13th of 1992, Mr. Norris was seated in apartment E during court proceedings, and he was wearing a button which I was informed by the bailiff stated, fuck judges without justice. At that time, I asked, came out onto the bench, was able to actually view the button. However, I did not read the button. I was informed that that's what it said. At that time, I asked Mr. Norris to either remove the button from his clothing or to leave the courtroom. And I did approve, by the way, his request to cover the hearing and proceedings that were going on in that courtroom for his piece of order or the street shit sheet, I believe. So at that time, I did ask him to take those actions, either to cover the button or take off the button or leave the courtroom. And he indicated to me that he refused to do so because of the fact that he felt it was a statement of his First Amendment constitutional rights. The button, I felt, did display obscene or insolent language affronting judges and also affronting court staff and people in custody, as well as their families and children and people who were forced to be in the courtroom and had no other recourse but to be there. The defendant, as I indicated, or Mr. Norris, refused to obey the order of the court. The court then had the bailiff peacefully escort Mr. Norris out of the courtroom. And shortly thereafter, that was from the back door of the Department E facility. He thereafter came around to the front door and returned to the courtroom, came back into the courtroom, still displaying the button, still refusing after my warning to remove the button or leave the courtroom, and once again indicating that he refused to comply with the court's order. By doing so, he further disrupted the proceedings by his refusing to remove the button, and by having the court have to disrupt the proceedings once again in order to deal with Mr. Norris's interruption. I will indicate that this behavior did occur in the immediate view and presence of the court pursuant to Civil Code Procedure Section 1211, and I will also include the notation that the court warned Mr. Norris as to his conduct prior to citing him for contempt. Specifically, I warned him the first time to please take off the button and leave the courtroom. He did not. He was escorted from the courtroom. The second time I warned him was when he came back in after being removed from the courtroom, and he once again refused to remove the button or leave the courtroom. I cited him for contempt. I then appointed counsel at Mr. Norris's request. Public defender was appointed pursuant to Government Code Section 27706, and the matter was set for a hearing on March 19th. I was then informed by Mr. Pena, who was the public defender at the time, that Ms. Wales would prefer to appear on the case and take the case as a pro bono matter, and if I would continue it to a date convenient for Ms. Wales, that public defender should be relieved and Ms. Wells should be noted as counsel of record.
So at that time, I did renew the public defender, and I have appointed Ms. Wells, and then the matter was continued, and Ms. Wells requested the last time so that she might be prepared to proceed on the matter. At this point in the proceedings, it is proper for me to ask Mr. Morris and through Ms. Wells if there is any explanation, excuse, or apology for the conduct that was witnessed by the court. And I don't just mean with the button, I mean returning to the courtroom after you have been ordered to leave or to discontinue displaying the button.
Again, I would like to clear up a procedural matter here. I understood this was a contempt hearing of some sort where he would be entitled to confront the witnesses against him.
There was no actual proceeding for that in the Code of Civil Procedure.
But when you do decide to hear a hearing, it is in the nature of a criminal proceeding, and it has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt once there's a hearing. He is entitled to his due process rights to hear and confront the witnesses against him. I had prepared for an actual hearing process.
Who do you intend to call as witness?
I intended to call you, Your Honor. I intended to call Mr. Norris. And I intended to call witness Mr. Ostrowski as to the demeanor of Mr. Norris throughout the proceedings, that it was not, in fact, disrupted.
Okay, so the disruption was in that it disrupted the proceedings which were taking place in the private room. Not that he stood on the tables or threw anything around, or it was merely that the court had to stop proceedings in order to deal with Mr. Norris and his behavior in the courtroom. If you wish to call witnesses who can testify otherwise, then I certainly would be willing to hear those.
Well, it's our position, Your Honor, that basically there was no disruption going on until Your Honor called attention to the button. There had been no one in the audience who complained about it. There were, I think, at least two squalling babies who were making quite a bit more, much more disruption than a bit more. I mean, Mr. Norris was making no disruption in the court, and had the court not made an issue of it, there would have been no disruption of the proceedings whatsoever. In addition to the important First and Fourth Amendment, 14th Amendment free speech issues in this case, I think make it important to have a full hearing with his due process rights. What I want to get straight here is what the proceedings are. I mean, I hadn't understood that this was just going to be you were going to tell your side and then basically decide. Is that what the hearing was about?
According to the Code of Civil Procedure, that is basically the procedure that is directed.
And I had understood
if you were to call Mr. Norris in regard to you. To anything that he has to say or any testimony that he wishes to give, I certainly think that would be in order and I'd be glad to hear it.
Well, I think that this is an unusual circumstance. Generally, there is no hearing with a direct contempt.
Right.
But I think that once you have decided to have a hearing, that he is entitled to his due process rights, which includes confronting witnesses against him, and the prosecution or the person alleging the contempt is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it occurred, and he has a right to cross-examine those people. That he has no obligation to say anything.
No, I agree. However, under, I believe it is 1211 and EDSEC, I believe that the crucial issue here is to whether or not there is some type of mitigating circumstance which would convince the court otherwise that he should not be held in contempt. And that's the reason why I wish to put the matter off to appoint counsel and ask if, in fact, you wish to present any testimony or evidence that would present to the court an explanation or an excuse or an apology of any kind. I certainly am not I'm not expecting to receive an apology. However, I believe that there might possibly be some type of explanation or excuse which Mr. Norris wishes to present, and that's the reason why I am asking for any evidence that you wish to present as well today.
Okay,
I don't believe that it is proper to have a confrontational type of criminal proceeding at this time with further testimony, et cetera. I think that if there is anything that Mr. Norris wishes to say to the board prior to my making a decision on this intent issue, then that's what I need to hear at this point.
Okay, well, I would object to that procedure. I think he is entitled to, in fact, a confrontational hearing at this point. Once you have said he is entitled to a hearing. And I would also like the opportunity at some point to argue the constitutional issues involved in the case. Is that going to be possible, or? Well, obviously the seminal case we have on this issue, the only case that even comes close to being on point is Cohen versus California.
I'm sorry, Cohen?
Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. Basically, as I said, we have prepared for a totally different process than we've been confronted with here today. Not to mention the fact that we also had been preparing to defend to one or A1 and 5 instead of A1 and 2. My client would like continuance to be able to prepare a statement if that's in fact what he is now entitled to do by the court. Time to prepare something like that rather than testimony as we had anticipated. If we could get a continuance to better prepare for this type of procedure, that's what we would request at this time.
At this time, the request for a continuance is to leave.
So, where are we now?
Is there anything that Mr. Norris would like to say?
I would like the jury to make the arguments first, that would be the end of my statement.
Very well. Okay. Okay, so anyway, getting back to Cohen versus California. The court ruled that the conviction, this was a misdemeanor conviction for disturbing the peace, basically for wearing a jacket that said fuck the draft. The court ruled that the conviction in that case rested solely upon a speech, which is analogous to the situation here. That the defendant's vulgar allusion to the selective service system did not constitute obscene expression. That the words used by the defendant did not fall within the constitutional principle authorizing the state to prescribe the use of fighting words. That the state of California could not excise as offensive conduct one particular scurrilous epithet from the public discourse. And that absent a more particularized and compelling reason for its actions, the state could not consistently with the First and 14th Amendment make the defendant's simple display of a four-letter expletive a criminal offense. They went on to say that so long as the means are peaceful, the communication need not meet the standards of acceptability to be protected by the First and 14th Amendments. And the reason for this, a compelling reason for this, is that otherwise the government might soon seize upon the censorship of particular words as a convenient guise for banning the expression of unpopular views. The contempt power is there to protect the integrity of the court, but according to the California appellate court in a case called a George versus Superior Court, 1974 case, that it must do so with great caution, so as not to stifle freedom of speech. That it's a drastic remedy to be employed only when necessary for the proper and orderly conduct of judicial proceedings. And in the case of Trunkington versus the Municipal Court of San Francisco, 1948 case, 85 Gallup second, 631, the court states, a judge, as such, is no more committed to use the contempt process to punish an affront than is a private individual. Speech in question may have an adverse emotional impact on the audience. In public debate, we must tolerate insulting and even outrageous speech in order to provide adequate breathing space to the freedoms protected by the First Amendment.
It's yours.
Okay, it's yours.
Well, I hadn't been aware that I was going to present this kind of statement today, so it's impromptu.
It's fine.
And
just say what you think, and the manner which is presented is certainly not the important thing.
Right, there were witnesses that were going to testify, as so my attorney has told me, as the fact that I was, as I always do in courts, concerned about due process of law for all the defendants that are there, and respect for the staff of the courts, including yourself, as an individual. As you know, and I'm sure you're aware, I've been a critic of yours and other judges in the public arena. That is neither here nor there. We were expected to treat each other fairly here in the courtroom. I've been in many courts over the years, and many of them in Santa Cruz. I've never been cited for contempt before. I show respect for court processes. But I do feel very strongly, as I told you some weeks ago, that there has to be an inviolable area of personal speech and privacy which is not trammeled, intimidated, or becomes a part of the state and court's own jurisdiction. This is essential because the court must be the servant of the public and not the other way around, as I'm sure you agree. In wearing the button, court, I was not attempting to express any general contempt for the institution of the Santa Cruz courts, although I have my difficulties at times with them. I was concerned with a particular matter, actually a number of matters. I'm deeply troubled with actions by local politicians and judges that harass homeless people. I've been working in that area for some time. Particularly regarding a Santa Cruz ordinance called the City Sleeping Ban 6.36.010, which you're most familiar with, which has been responsible for wholesale harassment of dozens, if not hundreds, of people in the last 6 months as a cause for driving people into the bushes and making it impossible for them to do the thing which every other normal citizen can do with a matter of course. Some months ago, a homeless man, after hours of research and months of repeated court appearances, received a ruling that acknowledged that homeless people could not be jailed for refusing to do community service pursuant to this cruel, stupid, and senseless law, the Santa Cruz City Sleeping Bill. Your Honor summarily reversed that ruling, took that man into your court, and improperly sent him to jail. That man was Robert Floyd. We're both familiar with him. He was sent to jail by Your Honor. That ruling, that decision by Your Honor was reversed. 4 days later, on writ habeas corpus by Superior Court's Judge Stevens, and then I guess it was yesterday or the day before by Superior Court Judge Kelsey, who found the entire contempt proceeding was the legitimate and appropriate did not respect the rights of that defendant. These may seem harsh words to say to you, but they are said with the intention of seeing a change in the judicial proceedings. There's no reason that the judiciary can't evolve an understanding of the needs and the rights of homeless people, just as other institutions locally hope for a really evolve and change in that respect. This particular button, which I have, which is a strong one and a harsh one, I received no complaints from anyone within the courtroom that day. In fact, the contrary. Your Honor, as my attorney said, wasn't aware of the button until it was brought to your attention by the bailiffs. I feel that you were extending yourself into an area that prompted a confrontation and a disruption in the courtroom, but by ignoring it, as every other judge has done in this jurisdiction, with the exception of Judge Mulligan, and that involved a very large issue which could be seen from the bench in a matter of an anti-war protest. But you are, in fact, creating a situation here which we find ourselves in today, which takes up even court time, which puts me in the peril of my own liberty, and which I feel is unnecessary. And what I'm trying to say here is, I think an individual who has made a mistake, whether she or he is high or lowly placed, there's no shame in saying, I erred on this matter. There's no shame in saying, I felt at the time it was inappropriate upon examination of the arguments. I feel that nonetheless, we're a broad enough-minded community in Santa Cruz to be able to deal with it. 1.5-inch political button on somebody's t-shirt without making it an issue, even though it hasn't been an issue. In terms of mitigating circumstances, there are many people who need that jail space. There are people out there who are hurting other people, as Your Honor knows. You see them purple. I don't feel that what I've done injures the public. I don't feel it injures the dignity of your court. I mean, this is 1992. And I think it would be a waste of personnel's time, personnel's money, court's time, jail space. And it would also subject Your Honor to some, I think, unnecessary public mockery to carry this matter through. I feel that by saying, let's leave this issue where it is, and provided people aren't jumping up and shouting epithets in court and actually disrupting the process, that every individual citizen is entitled to certainly the right to wear a political button in an election year. There was no jury present. No one was influenced in any way that could be construed as abridging the process of justice. And I throw myself on the mercy of the court. From the Justice Department, let me just say that.
Anything else? Just what, I guess he has a right to know what, in fact, he is facing in terms of punishment here.
At the time that I make my ruling, I'll indicate that. And your statements are not taken lightly, because I, in my personal outside of my job, may agree with you on many of the things that you say. Affecting change is not an easy thing to do, but I think sometimes your efforts are misguided, Mr. Morris, only because of the fact that what you need to do is change the legislation, change the ordinance in the city. Not necessarily, the court is not here to make new law. The court is here to enforce the law, good, bad, or otherwise. And the problem is, I think, that what we need to do as a society is change the law, perhaps, and not necessarily try to affect change from the back end, but rather the front end. So I also, your comments have made a great deal of difference to me in that I view the situation perhaps a little differently than I would have on the day that it happened. My concern is that it's not just the button. I mean, the button is not the whole point of this contempt proceeding. Let me speak first to the button. The contents of the button, the courtroom, although we may disagree philosophically, the courtroom is not a political arena. The courtroom is supposed to be a neutral arena for the resolution of disputes. We may not always agree on things, but we discuss in the courtroom, and in fact, advocacy is the whole purpose of having a courtroom active. However, I do not particularly care for anyone wearing political buttons or memorabilia or whatever in the courtroom, only because I feel that it sometimes will change the ruling of the court or the ruling of the jury or whatever, such as mothers against drunk drivers, if I was to allow people to wear the buttons of that nature, you're right, in front of the jury, it would perhaps make them impartial. And deny a person fair and impartial trial. And in public. And in public, I certainly agree that these are the rules, and I, and you, and everyone must tolerate perhaps more than we would in other locations. In public, your button does not offend me. In the courtroom, it doesn't. It said there were children in the courtroom at the time, and I don't feel that it is proper to force people who have no other recourse to see their relatives or their people or their court proceedings, but to be, and the court staff, which clearly must be there at the direction of the court, to view this type of stuff if it is not absolutely critical. And of course, your argument is that it is critical to effect change. My statement is it is an affront to the court as well as the court staff and those who are forced to be in the courtroom. Content of the button is not the point. The other point, well, it is what actually started this whole thing, but the concern that I have is I ask you to either remove it or leave the courtroom. If you made your statement that it is, in fact, a statement of your First Amendment freedom to make whatever statements you wished, and I agree with you that outside the courtroom we have that right. Inside the courtroom, I asked you to remove it or else leave the courtroom. At that point, you refused to do so, and I asked the deputies to escort you out. You very nicely walked out of the courtroom without making a statement or a scene or anything else. However, then you thereafter came out to the other door and returned into the courtroom, continuing to display the button, which interfered with the court proceedings and was against the court's order. And that is also the second area or more controlling area of the contempt in this regard.
May I ask you something?
Sure.
My understanding is that a court order that is issued that is on such a matter as freedom of speech, and I thought this was not a freedom of speech, I'm not a disruptive courtroom, which is void, is not the basis for, you know, I'm under no obligation to obey. That was my feeling at the time. And in saying that, and hearing me have something to say about that, again, I was not attempting to disrupt the court proceeding. I felt that, as a matter of example, anyone else in this situation, as a matter of encouraging people who have to assert their rights as human beings in our society, whether in court or elsewhere, and then through, I think it's important that this be done in court, legitimate rights must be asserted. I felt it was appropriate to essentially challenge Your Honor's ruling. It was not intended as a form of contempt of Your Honor. It was intended to say, Your Honor, I feel that's inappropriate, and upon appeal, upon further consideration and argument, considering Cohen versus California and other decisions, you yourself will come to the understanding that however, you know, disagreeable it may be in some respects, it's still a basic right in that situation. So the reason I didn't leave was not because I was trying to be confirmationist, but because I felt the order was invalid. That was the reason. And when I returned, because as Your Honor points out, I was reporting the matter for the speech issue, and I needed to get back into court to do that. And when Your Honor did cite me for contempt, when I returned the third time, as you may remember, the button was covered.
Yes, that was after I appointed counsel, and I hope that was, and at that point I allowed you to remain in the
courtroom. Counsel didn't recommend that, but I felt that in order, because I realized you were going to continue to stop the proceedings every time that happened. I didn't want to disrupt your proceedings or have you disrupt your own proceedings. So I want to point out that in order to stop that, so the issue could be decided at a hearing such as this, I did that. So I don't regard my refusing to leave on that occasion, or my actually I was slow to leave, as an act of contempt.
And if I might, I have a citation that basically is right on point. It's a case called McComb versus Superior Court of San Francisco, 1977, case 68, Cal. 3rd, 89. And basically, the ruling there was an order that's made in violation of one's constitutional rights is issued without or in excess of the court's jurisdiction and cannot produce a valid judgment of contempt. So that's basically, I think, what we're basing the order on.
Very well. At this time, and I think that we all have our positions on the record, and what I will do is, after due consideration, the court finds Mr. Norris guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of contemptuous behavior pursuant to CCP section 1209 subsection A subsection 1 as follows: disorderly, contemptuous, or insolent behavior toward the judge while holding court, tending to interrupt the due course of trial or other judicial proceedings, and 1209 subsection A2, a breach of the peace or disturbance tending to interrupt the due course of trial or other judicial proceedings. At this time, I would assume that Mr. Norris would not wish to pay a fine in regard to these contempt proceedings.
That's correct.
Very well. Then the contemptor is sentenced to 2 days in the county jail. I had intended to make it 5 days, but after your statements and comments, I do tend to feel that those are mitigating, and because of that, I am going to reduce my previous decision to 2 days in the county jail. I would assume that you would like to have a stay pending the filing of a petition for extraordinary relief.
Exactly.
Okay. And under the Code of Civil Procedure section 128 subsection B and 1209 subsection C, I believe that although Mr. Norris is not one of the people described there in those code sections, I feel that the direction is helpful in that it indicates 3 judicial days for the filing of that petition. And so what I will do is go ahead and put it over to April 22nd at 8:30. So that he may file, and I will have the order prepared today by 5 o'clock so that you may pick that up tomorrow if you wish to do so in order to file your petition.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And Mr. Norris, I guess that what I need to do is order that you return to the court on the 22nd at 8:30, depending if you have papers to present to me from the Superior Court or something of that nature, and then we can proceed at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and he says, Oscar, I would like to have a copy of that transcript so that I can...
And so Judge Moore stayed her ruling pending Judge Stevens, who's the judge above her, the appeals judge. If he would grant a writ, then she would delay it. Well, we got a writ from Stevens, and we served it on her, but she jailed me anyway, and I served 2 days in solitary confinement in the county jail. When we brought the issue up later, trying to figure out why I was being jailed when the order was supposed to be stayed, she claimed she had never received the stay, which both of us, Kate Wells and myself, knew to be false because we had delivered the order to her bailiff. So Kate feels that Judge Morris was not being malicious, that she was simply fucked up and was covering her tracks. But in any case, the issue, whether one can wear a button into a courtroom that says, "Fuck judges without justice," resulted in my being jailed for 2 days here in Santa Cruz, and I have since worn that button into court, though not into her court, mainly because her court is in Watsonville and I don't show up there, and also because I have to be ready to go to jail to do that. That issue is an important one, and one which remains a hot one. For instance, you may remember, you heard Kate Wells, the attorney, talking about the 1969 Cohen versus California decision, which talked about the right to wear "fuck the draft" on the back of a jacket, I believe it was, in the corridors of the courtroom. Judicial authority was perennially expanding itself inappropriately. For instance, 2 months ago, perhaps it was even less, I was in court with Becky Johnson, and Becky was engaging in some sort of civil proceeding she was trying to have resolved, and the bailiff, first of all, told us we couldn't enter the courtroom with a tape recorder, even though the tape recorder was off. This is in McAdams Court. And then he told us that if I gave away flyers, which I was doing in the corridors of the courtroom, I would be arrested, which of course was completely ridiculous. And of course, I continued to give away flyers, and he called his supervisor over, and the supervisor kind of looked at him and said, "No, you can't arrest him for giving away flyers," frustrating the poor bailiff. So So the attempt to regiment, repress, and intimidate people in the court continues, and of course that's necessary because the whole business of the courts is injustice. It's a form of class warfare against poor people. Where, for instance, if you go into Mad Dog Mulligan's court, or Meat Grinder Mulligan as I call him, he's the referee of the traffic court, the judge down there in the basement of the county building, his main job is to turn out fines and squeeze poor people, because of course rich people don't even bother to go into those courts because they just pay their fines and they go on their way. The poor people who need to contest their fines have to deal with Meat Grinder Mulligan, who won't let you contest a fine if it's over $100, so he does you the favor of reducing your fine to $101, and then you get to go to the community service department or the community slavery department, as some call it, and pay them $25 with the privilege of them doing volunteer labor. It's quite a racket, needs to be exposed, and hopefully we'll be doing more exposing about it in the future. So that was a bit of history for you. In my next show, I hope to cover police review and what's been going on there, I should say lack of police review. Also, for those who are interested, today on Monday at 5 o'clock, if you want to go to India Joe's restaurant, you can meet with Supervisor Marty Wormhout. Marty has her sort of pre-supervisors meeting get-together every Monday at 5 at India Joe's restaurant. For those of you who are covering county politics, who want to, for instance, get Marty to make a stronger statement on the cannabis club situation, or possibly on the attacks on medical marijuana users like Elizabeth, like Ben Robinson and others, not as famous as those who I've just mentioned, but equally important. Also, the Board of Supervisors meets, of course, Tuesday, tomorrow, and you may actually be able to show up at 120 Campbell Street if you want to go over there during this broadcast to check out what's happening with the attempted eviction of the Campbell Street irregulars, as I call them, who are being dumped out into the street in spite of apparently promises and rights that they have around the issue of relocation funding. In our county, it is so hard to find a place to live that is anywhere near affordable that it becomes a serious crisis, I think, when families and friends and children even are tossed out into the street because profiteers want to remodel their homes and, you know, raise the rents, and because the city doesn't want to do anything to deal with the rights of folks who are renting in them. Renters are really a key part of this whole situation for the whole chance we have of any meaningful change in Santa Cruz. Then on, of course, Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Loudon Nelson, there'll be the SCAN meeting at 7 o'clock where we hope that candidates who support the right of homeless people to sleep at night, like David Minton Silva and Kristen Anderson, will receive the SCAN nod. Actually, it's more likely that somebody like Eleanor Eisenberg, who will not take a position on the sleeping ban, or possibly Catherine Byers, who takes a position but then takes no action on the sleeping ban, are likely to get the nod. But anyone can go to that meeting. It's an open meeting, although you can no longer be a SCAN, sign up to be a SCAN member and vote. I think they put in a week's delay after apparently Scott Kennedy did a famous sign up everybody at a schmoozing session and march them all over to endorse him in 1994 when he had just done the ban the beggars law himself, and then of course whipped on his other hat as the guided by Gandhi guru. That's all for this week. Let's go out on a song by Peggy Seeger, A Nation of Animal Lovers.
We don't pretend we're perfect, but we have endearing features. We're honest and we're always kind to God's four-footed creatures. Dogs and horses, hamsters, rabbits, little furry things. Lousy Europeans can't appreciate the pleasure that a little kindness brings. We're a nation of animal lovers. When Greeks are being tortured, then we tend to hold our peace. We often like to spend our summer holidays in Greece. Cats and ponies, budgies, moths and hairy caterpillars. Lousy Europeans can't appreciate the pleasure that these little creatures give us. We're a nation of animal lovers. When there's massacres in Vietnam, we just avert our gaze. But we're tender-hearted to a fault with alley cats and strays. Remember how the nation nearly had a nervous spasm, breathlessly anticipating giant panda's pleasure in a cuddly orgasm. We're a nation of animal lovers. When there's hangings in Rhodesia, we're impressively impassive. But be cruel to a horse and our reaction then is massive. Guinea pigs and painted terrapin, tropical fishes. Lesser races cannot understand the simple fact that it would meet with all our wishes if there were no human beings.
Our boys are standing tall out there, full of guts and pride. Except the ones who can't stand up, the ones who went and died. I knew a guy was crazy keen to have a piece of land. Now he's got 6 feet of earth and far off Vietnam. Poor wayfaring stranger, rambling through the town. Draft board sent him overseas and laid that poor boy down. Our boys are standing tall and proud and some are lying flat. The honored guests at barbecues where only worms get fat. Joe Baker talked of raising wheat under Kansas skies. Now shoots of rice are growing from the sockets of his eyes. I knew a guy from Fresno, Chicano for his dirt. Now he's lying in a ditch with a medal on his shirt. Big Bill, a black from Harlem, demanded equal rights. He got 'em when they buried him with a half a dozen whites. Our boys are standing tall and proud, sons of Uncle Sam, bringing the American way of life to backward Vietnam. Help United Steel survive, Kowalski fought and bled. The shareholders are doing fine, but Joe Kowalski's dead. Black kid from Atlanta, serving Uncle Sam, died for General Motors in the fields of Vietnam. I knew a guy from Texas by the name of Billy Doyle. He died in the Mekong Delta, defending Standard Oil. The white man drafts a black man to fight the yellow guy.